Our mothers always warned us, always wear clean underwear, always finish the food on your plate. There are children starving in other countries. Never talk to strangers. But do we listen to her? Of course not. And because of that, we have to pay the penalty. Sounds like the perfect time for episode 40 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film for the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your I Left the Cucumbers Behind host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. Today, I am happy to welcome writer, producer, director Robert Brody, who has chosen the Nicole Kidman, Sam Neill, Billy Zane three-handed thriller, Dead Calm. And I have chosen Roman Polanski's freshman feature, the Polish art house classic, Knife in the Water, both about a couple who pick up a stranger and find themselves in sexual and physical conflict while on a boat at sea. To begin, Robert, why don't you tell our audience something about yourself?
Well, I came to L.A. about 4 years ago. In the early 90s, I directed a feature called Through Dead Eyes, a low-budget horror film shot for pennies, but it was shot on 35mm stock. It's the days before digital. And I produced, wrote, and directed this feature, which was sold. It's pretty bad, but it was my first attempt at directing anything. I had such a bad experience making that movie that I pretty much abandoned film for the most part for a good many years and became a professional sailor and a yacht broker and tried my hand at various other things. And then about 6 years ago, I wrote a script called Red Sky that also takes place at sea. And it won the Page Awards. It won the Fresh Voices Screenplay Awards. And that brought me out to L.A., got me management, and I am now back in the business, unfortunately, working on getting a couple of films made and trying to sell some scripts. That is my bio in a nutshell.
Fantastic. And I think we're beginning to see why you chose the film you did.
At the time that Dead Calm came out, it's 1989. The director was a George Miller, I believe.
No, Philip Noyce.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, correct. A film like that, to go mainstream, was kind of unusual. Movies at sea are typically, with Titanic being the outsider, not big budget, not well received most of the time. They're very hard to shoot. This ended up being a launching point for Nicole Kidman. It certainly made me notice Billy Zane, who to this day I think is really an underrated talent. And it was an unusual film at the time, something I didn't expect. It was sort of like The Hitcher at sea, tense, obviously confined. I don't want to say it's a noir, but it has elements of noir. Top of that, it involves sailing, which is a passion of mine.
With that, then let's get to your selection, Dead Calm. First, some information about the film. Dead Calm is an Australian film released in 1989. It was directed by Philip Noyce and written by Terry Hayes, adapted from the novel of the same name written by Charles Williams. And it was produced by George Miller.
Hence my confusion.
It stars Sam Neill, Nicole Kidman, and Billy Zane. The basic premise revolves around a couple who are suffering from the death of their little boy in a traffic accident the mother blames herself for. To help his wife recover from the trauma, the husband takes her on a sea voyage. But while drifting along, they come upon a ship and then a dinghy being rowed toward them by a young man who claims to be the sole survivor of the ship. But when the husband doesn't quite believe his story and goes to the other ship to check things out, the wife finds herself fighting for her and her husband's survival when the man turns out to be a murderous psychopath. So I think you may have talked about this a bit just now, but why did you choose this film?
Well, again, I think it was a signature piece in many respects, at least for this genre, this confined type of paranoid horror genre that this is. Obviously, she's stuck on a boat with a murderer, with a crazy person, which is ripe territory. On top of that, we have a parallel story with Sam Neill's survival attempt on a slowly sinking vessel. This was adapted from a book, of course, that I read a long time ago. I barely remember the book. I remember the movie better. And I think it's also just one of those movies that always stuck with me because it's so performance-oriented. There's a lot of tight close-ups. The actors really don't have any room to not be acting. The camera is right on top of them. It's just an intense viewing, even today. I actually showed it to my 16-year-old son about a month ago, and he was really struck by it. He really enjoyed it. So even though it's an older film, it still carries quite a punch.
I saw it, like you, when it first came out, and my reaction to it at the time was summarized by something someone once said about a play that they had read. It's a movie that doesn't do anything, but does it very well.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you expound on that?
Well, it's just a thriller. That's it. It doesn't do anything beyond that. It doesn't really try to do much beyond that. But it was very well made. It was very well acted. It was very tense. At least at the time for me, worked very well. I think I have some issues with it now that I've seen it again, and we can get into that as the dialogue goes along. But yes, there is a certain set of films that I watch where I go, wow, this is just really entertaining. It doesn't do anything, but boy, it really does it really, really well.
You say it doesn't do anything, and I might counter that claim by saying, let's look at the character. She is a mother, obviously a loving mother, who's in a tragic accident. It's really not her fault what happens. At the beginning of the movie, the child unbuckles his safety restraints, and that ends up killing him when she has an accident. But she suffered a terrible loss, and in addition to fighting for her life, she's fighting for her husband's life. She's trying to stop this flood of loss. She's just not going to accept yet one more loss, especially her husband's life, which is really seems to be her paramount concern, even above her own life in the movie, especially when she finds out that his ship is sinking. I don't know whether that qualifies, that in the grand scheme of things, that's a good theme, but I think this refusal to give in to loss is a theme that the movie does explore, although maybe on a primal level. That makes it a little bit more than what meets the eye, at least as just a simple thriller.
I think you make some good points there, but I think maybe that's one of the reasons why upon seeing it again, I'm not sure it quite holds up as well for me. I mean, it still has some of the elements that made it work the first time I saw it. Beautiful to look at. It's very well edited, very well acted. But I'm not sure that the metaphor is quite working as well as perhaps it needs to be for it really to be solidly about what you think it is, because the movie is called Dead Calm, and that's where Nicole Kidman is. She's in a place of dead calm. She cannot move forward. She is just stuck. And metaphorically, then, so should the ship they're on. But they don't really make a big deal about it. They're certainly not stuck because they have an engine, but even without that, they don't say, well, we haven't moved for days because there's no wind. We're just going along. They never talk about the ship basically being stuck because there's no wind to sail. So theoretically, by the end of it, what should happen after she goes through all of this, then the wind should come up and the ship is no longer stuck in dead calm, and neither is she. But I think that metaphor is getting lost in some of the things that have been added to the movie that are very different from the book, even from the film that Orson Welles tried to make out of it.
Right. Okay. Well, let me point out a couple of things. While they're in calm conditions, they're not stuck. Any ship like that has auxiliary diesel engine. She can motor probably 700 to 1,000 miles.
But only if she chooses to.
Yeah,
if she's
done. Right. And that leads us to some problems that I have with the film, which have bugged me since the day I saw it, is the technical inaccuracies. The boat running out of fuel when a boat like that could literally motor for days.
I thought that was a little odd. Right. At the back of my mind, I was going, well, surely Sam Neill should have known they were running low on gas. Is
right.
there more gas on the ship that they can feed?
Well, I own a 40-foot sailboat and professional sailor, so usually a vessel like that is good for at least 500 nautical miles on her single tank of fuel. But a vessel of that size, I believe that boat was in the 65-foot range. She'd have quite a lot of range. Now, of course, we don't know how much fuel they've used up to this point. Maybe they ran through it the last week.
Yeah, and I would think Sam Neill would be saying, you know, we've got to get to shore.
Right, but they're supposed to be 500 or 1,000 miles out to sea. So
yeah.
The other aspect of this is that when she's communicating with him via VHF radio on board, which has got about a 25-mile range, so that's a great device to use because she can reach him and they can communicate in some way, but she can't call for help with that because it's only good for about 25 miles. Unfortunately, in all those scenes, right above the VHF radio is a single sideband radio, commonly called an SSB, which is a radio that can call China. Like, she can use that radio at any time to call the Coast Guard, right? It's just sitting there because obviously they figured nobody would know. But it always bothered me that right there is literally the hotline to Batman and she's not using it.
I suppose one could say that, as so often happens in a lot of movies, her technical expertise depends on what is needed to move the plot forward the way the writer and director wants the plot to be moved forward.
Right.
At times, she's brilliant at the ship. She knows how to steer it. She knows how to run things and do things. Then at other times, when it's convenient for the plot, suddenly she doesn't.
Right. But basically, almost nobody, unless they're a sailor, is going to know that. It's like watching a race car movie. If you're an experienced race car driver, you're going to pull your hair out at all the technical mistakes.
Exactly. What are some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
Another thing I'd like to quickly point out, which will lead me to my favorite scene, is this is an early film where the woman really takes control and wins the day physically. She battles this physically larger, more powerful guy and triumphs. It's not just outwitting him. She really has to be tough. And she's a very strong female character at a time where we had only seen that in a few movies. You know, obviously Aliens is probably the biggest pioneer of that decade in that respect. It was a very powerful female character out to save her husband and essentially defeat a crazed and very fit young man in a confined space. And that leads me to my favorite scene, obviously, is the scene where she gets him off the boat and dumps him into a life raft and then hunts for her husband. Trying to find him before he drowns is a very powerful moment for me.
I have a favorite scene that's very minor, something a screenwriter would point out, and that is when Nicole Kidman throws the keys to the boat into the water and the dog jumps
in. The dog goes to get it. That's great. The dog fetches the floating keys.
Because it's well set up.
Yes.
She throws the ball off and it's a thing the dog does, goes into the water, fetches the ball and brings it back.
Right.
So the screenwriter, Terry Hayes, sets this up very well. And this was Terry Hayes's contribution because there is no dog, I believe, in the book. And it also has, I think, a very funny line that I swear must have been improvised. And that's when Billy Zane is calling to the dog, come to me, come to me, and then says backstroke.
Right, right. That whole sequence is humorous in spite of the horror.
Right.
It's a fascinating moment. Billy Zane really deserves a lot of credit for why this movie works. He's scary and he's funny and he's also, there's something very attractive about him. He's a really good looking guy. It's a breakout performance. I just wish his career had been bigger.
I never quite understood that either. When I saw Titanic and Dead Calm, I never understood why his film career wasn't much stronger. It could be that he tended to play bad guys, and that may have made it a bit more difficult.
That's always been, what do they call it, the film Bad Day at Black Rock. The scene where Ernest Borgnine is antagonizing Spencer Tracy, and Spencer Tracy basically beats the hell out of him with one arm. But Ernest Borgnine is such a reprehensible type of man that I heard from my mother years ago, she said that affected his career, that it changed the way people looked at Ernest Borgnine, who had previously been seen as a very positive type of personality. It negatively impacted his career. And so you might be right. Billy Zane being in two pretty horrific roles where he plays a real creep might have hurt his star power.
Well, he is a working actor, though. If you look at his IMDb, he never seems to have been lacking for work. But if he had gotten an Oscar nomination for Titanic, that might have.
He, along with that David Warner, who plays his henchman in that, they're perfect villains. So I agree. That's a great scene. And I also want to point out, just as a little moment in there where he's at first gets on the boat, he's hijacked her, and they're having their first big argument, and he's screaming at her about his mania. He's completely out of his mind, and he says, "You're so much like Ray, it's scary." That moment where he's comparing her to the people he's murdered is a truly terrifying moment and perfectly brought home by his performance. And from that point on, the movie really is firing on all cylinders.
Well, it might be interesting to talk about some more of the differences between the book and the movie that Orson Welles made, the incomplete movie
right.
that he was never able to finish, because apparently his movie is much closer to the book. There is no death of a child. The couple is on a honeymoon. There is no dog. There are other survivors. When the Sam Neill character, John, gets over to the other boat, Huey, the Billy Zane character, his wife is still alive, as is the person who rented the boat. So there are three people on that boat trying to survive. There is no real sexual undertone in the original. There is no what today would be considered a rape scene. At the time, it's just an uncomfortable sex scene. The original character has no real sexual interest. And there's no death of the dog, since there is no dog. The movie has become more exploitational from the original book.
Yeah, more commercial too, of course.
Yeah.
Have you seen the work print footage from The Deep?
I've seen a couple of scenes from it. I saw it in a documentary about his incomplete works. When I saw the scenes, I said, oh, wait, isn't that Dead Calm? And yes, it was. Some people actually think that there's enough of it there to release, but we don't know. But of course, he couldn't finish it because Lawrence Harvey, who played the role of Huey, died.
Right.
Jean Moreau is also in it. So they've really upped certain aspects in this version of it. The New York Times felt that the film was an unsettling hybrid of escapist suspense and the kind of pure trash that depends on dead babies and murdered dogs for effect.
New York Times, man.
Right.
So harsh. You know, one of the things I love about film is that people are entitled to have whatever view they want. But when I look at a film that's successful, and Deadcom was relatively successful, if I recall, and it's relatively well reviewed. When it comes down to really hard reviews like that, I wonder, did the reviewer have a bad day that day? What is the grand tragic offense of making a slick thriller like this that doesn't, as you say, ring any deeper bells of social commentary? Do we really need to do that for every movie? If so, then most movies shouldn't be made. I actually don't like the dead child part of the movie simply because it's unnecessarily upsetting and it's not a good backdrop for what's about to happen. I prefer them to be having a good time and have that change as opposed to a bad time getting worse.
I also didn't think it was very well done. When that child comes out through the window, it doesn't really look like the way a body would come through a window.
So let me counter that. At the time, I remember being in the theater. This is the first time I saw it. I do remember the audience gasping at that effect. The audience was very troubled by that shot. And I still find it disturbing. Now it doesn't look as real to me.
Right.
But I think you have to also look at it through the eyes of somebody who wasn't as used to sophisticated effects at the time. It's 31 years ago. And if now they wouldn't do it that way. And I don't think they would do it at all. They would never show that shot in a film today. I don't think.
It does sound like I'm being rather harsh on the film. I do want to say that the film is still very enjoyable. And in many ways, the film works very well. And it does have a lot going for it. So I think to a certain degree, I am being a little bit of a devil's advocate.
And again, everyone noticed how good Nicole Kidman was.
Right.
Like, Sam Neill's really, everybody's great in the film, but she really has her work cut out for her and she delivers. That did a lot to get her star power going.
There was one thing that I read that is kind of interesting. I don't think most people would think about. I certainly didn't think about. And I'm not sure it's totally fair. Nicole Kidman turned 20 while making this film. And Sam Neill then would have been around 39. If the child was 4 years old, that means she married a 36-year-old man at age 16 and was pregnant.
Right. I had no idea that she was that age at the time. I assume she was in her mid-20s.
And no one would. You would assume that she's a bit older.
She looked to be 25 to 30.
I did say that, Sam Neill is a lot older than Nicole Kidman, but it didn't really mean anything.
To me, Billy Zane looks younger than everybody in that movie.
Right. But speaking of Huey, that is another difference from the book and the original movie. In this movie, there's no explanation for Huey's psychosis. He's just sort of psychotic.
Right. He's a vampire. We just accept that he's the monster.
In the original book and the movie, there's a very definite reason for what happens. He has what is described as an agoraphobic reaction when he's scuba diving with the wife of the man who took them out on the boat. And because of that panic, he accidentally kills the wife who is scuba diving with him. It gives him a psychotic break. And he already has some sort of mental issue. He's a bit childlike. He's a sensitive artist. Here, it's much more existential. We don't really know why. He just is. That's not good or bad. In fact, being more existential, existentialism finally hit the movies in the U.S. in the 70s. So having an existential aspect of the movie actually might be a more interesting choice than to actually give a very detailed psychological reason for what happened.
As far as giving a backstory to him, I don't know how important it would be to the movie. I guess I would like to know why he's crazy, but again, watching the movie, I didn't really care. He just is. He's just a force of nature.
Right. But I do think there is something to adding these existential elements to the movies. Things happen and we often have no idea why. And it doesn't matter why. It's how I react to it.
Right. I agree.
So, what do you think of the technical aspects of the film, the director, Philip Noyce?
I think he's done a really good job in the pacing of the film, especially, as I'll explain later, I am shooting a film on a boat, hopefully this summer, if everyone gets vaccinated. And the tricks and requirements for shooting in a confined space at that time really difficult. And they had to build sets, of course. Not everything is shot on the boat.
And we'll talk more about that in Knife in the Water, because they also had some very difficult.
Right. But I think it was much harder on Dead Calm because they're shooting with some pretty heavy-duty cameras. On Knife in the Water, they're shooting with a lot of compact little cheapy cameras because they weren't trying to make a high-resolution, color, theatrical, gigantic-looking movie. They weren't looking for or expecting to get the look of anything like Dead Calm. So Dead Calm has to have a pretty highly technical quality to it that's really hard to achieve with a 35mm Arri or Panavision camera at that time, because those cameras were so physically large. Now you can go on a boat interior with a camera that fits in the palm of your hand and get fantastic results. You could not do that back then. I'm also a photographer, so looking at the cinematography in that movie, they did a great job. Sound work is good. There's not much of a musical score. It's more of an effect score, but it's effective. It's spooky and ghostly.
Dean Simler was the cinematographer.
That slouch?
Yes, the guy who did Dances with Wolves. And I think it is very beautifully shot. It also has a really nice music score by Graham Reville, who worked on other films by Philip Noyce. Have you seen many other Philip Noyce movies?
Offhand, I cannot think necessarily of what I've seen by Philip Noyce.
Never really quite broke out. He probably hit his peak with Rabbit Proof Fence and The Quiet American, with The Quiet American possibly being his best film.
He directed Clear and Present Danger. That's high end. Bone Collector, Salt. He certainly had some big moments.
He became a studio director.
You got to pay for the house and the car. So
that's right.
And he's still working.
One last thing to talk about is the ending.
Yeah.
Which is probably the weakest aspect.
Oh, it's incredibly stupid.
This was done at the request of Warner Brothers. So apparently, from what I understand, is that in preview screenings, the audience was unsatisfied. So they added this part where Huey is still alive and comes back. I think I might have been able to live with it, but it's not very well done.
No, it's terribly done. And by the way, I could shoot a flare at a sail 100 times, and every time it will bounce off of the sail, it will not go through it.
But this is the sort of ending that became very, very popular with Carrie.
Well, yeah. You have to have that spectacular, explosive death of the villain. Flair goes in his mouth. It's so ridiculous. I can't begin to tell you how impossible that all is.
But as we'll see in Knife in the Water, Knife in the Water was kept its ambiguous ending. But here, they wanted something very, very definite just to please the audience. And it probably did help at the box office.
Yeah, it probably did.
Well, with that, here's some more information about the movie. The film cost $10 million Australian dollars to make.
Australian dollars, so that means it cost $80 to make.
Not quite, but close. And it made $10.2 million Australian dollars in Australia. Grossed about $2,500,000 at the box office in Australia, which isn't much, but in the U.S., it grossed $7,825,000. So it did a nice, tidy profit.
I remember that it really achieved some status, just like The Hitcher, in the VHS, Betamax. It was a popular rental.
It won two awards at the Australian Film Institute. It won for music score and sound, but was nominated for picture, director, adapted screenplay, editing, cinematographer, production design. It lost the picture to A Cry in the Dark.
Oh, good movie.
Right. Yeah, I can't object to it losing to it.
Another spectacular female performance.
George Miller directed some sequences himself, including one where Sam Neill's character is tormented in the boat by a shark, but that scene ended up being dropped from the final film.
Oh, well, you know how I feel about sharks.
Before filming began, Nicole Kidman took lessons in how to operate the ship. So during the storm sequences near the end of the film, she's actually piloting the yacht.
Right.
The writer Terry Hayes also worked on Mad Max 2 and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And the source novel, Dead Calm, was actually partially inspired by a real incident.
Yeah, that I did not know.
It happened in 1961. A World War II vet was hired by a family to skipper a boat in the Bahamas. Also on the boat was Harvey's wife. So Harvey killed his wife, hoping to collect an insurance policy. He killed four members of the family, father, the mother, and two of the children, scuttled the boat and took off. And then when he was rescued, said that the boat sank in the storm. 11-year-old Terry Joe was asleep below deck. He didn't kill her, just expected her to die in the scuttling of the boat. But she woke up. She got on a Coke board and used it as a flotation device. She survived for 4 days without food or water, rescued by a Greek freight ship. So when Harvey was rescued by the Coast Guard and told them this story, later on they had to inform Harvey, by the way, we actually have a survivor from the ship. When Harvey found out about that, he committed suicide.
Oh, interesting.
And perhaps one of the biggest lessons of the film is never go sailing with Billy Zane. In this film, in Titanic and Survival Island, all the ships sink.
Yes.
That he's on, and he's the bad guy.
I've been very clear to any of my friends who are friendly with Billy Zane. We go sailing every weekend. He is not permitted on board.
Yes.
Find another ship.
Right. Well, with that, let's get to my selection, and that is Knife in the Water.
Oh.
Knife in the Water is a Polish film released in 1962. It was directed by Roman Polanski and written by Polanski, Jacob Goldberg, and Jerzy Skolimowski. It stars, and I'll probably get these wrong, Leon Niemczyk, Jolanta Umeka, and Zygmunt Milanowicz. The story revolves around a bourgeois couple, a writer and his younger wife, who are driving down to spend a day on their boat one Sunday. Along the way, they pick up a hitchhiker and then invite him along for their outing, which leads to sexual and physical tension and conflict among the trio. So what do you think of the pairing of the two films?
Well, I'm a big fan of Knife in the Water, and I'm probably an outlier in saying that it's actually my favorite Polanski film, although not as sophisticated as Chinatown, Rosemary's Baby, but it's just a film that I only actually saw it recently, maybe 8 or 9, 10 years ago. It's not a film that I saw back in my days of trying to catch up on every classic foreign film. It's my favorite Polanski film, and I'm not even 100% sure if I can explain why. It has elements of noir, which I also mentioned in relation to DITCOM, but it just takes its time. If you pitch what it is to somebody, it doesn't sound like they'll ever want to watch it. And yet, it's just like sort of watching the driving scenes in Psycho, that if you explain to somebody the driving scenes in Psycho that they're compelling, they'll never understand it until they watch the movie. There's a lot of silence. There's a lot of nothing happening or very little happening. And yet, it's all strangely voyeuristically compelling and tense. Like Dead Calm, it's confined. People are trapped together. It's a very enjoyable film.
I first saw it in college, and I've seen it a few times since, and I like it very much. I do think I do have to say that, to a certain degree, how much I enjoy watching it does depend on my mood. If I'm in a very impatient mood or I'm in a high energy mood,
yeah, then it's slow going, for sure.
The pacing is a bit leisurely. If I'm not, if I'm in the right mood, then I see more tension. It is a bit subtle to some degree with the way it dramatizes the tension, unlike Dead Calm, where the tension and the conflicts are just very obvious and very laid out before you. What are some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
I really enjoy the scenes initially in the car, before they even get on the boat. There's just something going on between those two actors. She has very little experience, and she has almost no credits. And as far as I know, nobody even knows what happened to her or where she is today, if she's even alive.
Right. The same for the hitchhiker. This is first film.
Right. But he went on. Everyone went on to do things, and she sort of vanished. She's very compelling. I find her to be one of the most beautiful, real-looking women in film history. But not in the way that women are beautiful in film that we've come to expect, but just looking completely natural, not a perfect body, not a perfect face. Somebody you might see in a grocery store. But by the end of the film, I think she has a certain sexual power over the audience that's quite unique and rare. It kind of builds up over the running time. The scene setting up in the car is the very beginning of that tense sexual impact that she has, the relationship with the husband, which obviously is not very good. If I had any favorite moments in the movie, I probably couldn't name any. The whole film for me just works. Obviously, the signature moment is when the young man is presumed dead and they're looking for him. But the whole film works for me just as a whole. It's not a film where there's any major set piece.
You mentioned the opening driving scene, and there is that one scene where the husband reaches over and takes control of the steering wheel.
Right.
When he does that, she just pulls over, gets out, and you see that this is a ritual. He does this all the time.
Yeah.
He has her drive. He doesn't like her driving. She's used to it. And she just gets out and gets to the other side and makes him drive. They don't exchange any words.
Right. This is not something you'd expect to see from somebody's first feature, that kind of subtle psychological character exposition. It's really unique. It shows how talented Polanski was, is. Obviously, I'm not a fan of Mr. Polanski because of his criminal actions, but there's no taking away from the power power of this particular film and some of the other films he did. Obviously, he's a talented man. But how many directors have a first feature that's this subtle, measured, and patient? I found it almost astonishing the first time I saw it.
It's also very beautifully shot. Another one of my favorite scenes is they feel like drone shots. But right. They're shot from the top of a mast, which caused some problems. You look down on the young man who's spread out on the deck, look down on the husband and the wife. It's very effective. There's something very beautiful, very calm, very interesting about these shots.
Absolutely. And again, unlike most movies of this type, this is being shot aboard a 30-foot wooden sailboat, a really small boat. Even by today's standards, 30-foot sailboats today are much larger. They're beamier. They're wider. They're almost twice the size of this boat in accommodation. This is a really technically tough thing to shoot, that they got so much done, especially with big, bulky equipment of the day. You know, like I said, I'm about to shoot a film on a boat and everybody's worried. And I'm like, don't be worried. Watch Knife in the Water. Look what they did. And they had cameras five times larger than ours.
Jesse Lipman did the cinematography, and there were a lot of technical difficulties when they were doing the car and they filmed the husband and wife in the very front. They didn't really have a way to do that at the time. So someone had to actually be tied to the front of the car. They had to shoot through a cloth. And hold up a cloth, I think, so that the reflection on the windshield would look a certain way, so that right. In driving the car, he couldn't do it by the road. He had to do it by the tops of the trees on the side. When they shot from the top mast, the problem was, of course, though the water was very still, the mast was still moving. So they had to tie the cameraman down. They didn't tie the camera down, and he dropped the camera into the water. Camera was never recovered.
Oh. We should go find it.
And then you're right. The boat was very small. So a great deal of the time, crew was tied up against the boat, leaning over the side or at the sides.
Right.
It was a very difficult shoot from that perspective.
Now, oddly, from a sailor standpoint, this movie gets things mostly done correctly. The last time I saw it was probably a year ago. I don't remember watching it and thinking, oh, they got that wrong. There's a few moments where the boat is being sailed badly just to get a shot. Whoever was in charge of making sure the boat was doing what it should be doing obviously paid attention, and Polanski obviously thought it was important to have that. So that also gave me a measure of respect. Obviously, they're not shooting on the high seas, so that made things a little easier.
I think they do something here that works a little better than in Dead Calm. By separating the husband and wife in Dead Calm and putting them on separate ships, to some degree, it reduced a bit of the tension for me, especially since they had to keep cutting back and forth and back and forth. Here, the tension is all on one boat, and it's between these three people, the husband and the young boy, who are in constant conflict, trying to outdo the other. Both physically, sexually, battling over Christina, the wife, for her attention. And I think that does help keep up the tension in a way that perhaps Dead Calm doesn't quite do for me. I always thought it was really interesting. They're going to sail this boat this Sunday. Nobody else is. There's nobody else out on this body of water. Nobody else is going down to sail their boats. It doesn't seem to be winter, so it doesn't seem like it's the weather that's keeping other people away.
Right.
And I think it sort of added to it this existential mood of they're the only people out here. We don't know why, but they're the only people.
I'll point this out. Sometimes we go sailing. We're in L.A., for God's sakes, and sometimes we're the only boat out.
Right.
I don't know why. And other times I go out and it's Grand Central Station. It's not a film that I see people trying to analyze it, and I think they overanalyze it. I think people read much more into it than actually Polanski ever intended, and he sits back and enjoys that, as a lot of filmmakers do. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Towards the end of the movie, there's a whole thing where she's yelling at the husband, "You're just like him," and this whole little bit of psychological exposition. And I always thought it was kind of good until I read that Polanski was forced to put that into the movie because the government was involved in the production and release of the film, and the film had to have some sort of social commentary or it wouldn't be released.
Well, that's not the only thing he had to add for that. And you're right. He had submitted the script. It was rejected because it had no socialist or propaganda content. So he went to France for a year. Then his mentor at the Film Institute said, "Come back. Things have changed. We'll just dicker with the script a little bit." And not only did he add that, he also added the conversation between the hitchhiker and the wife about him living in a student quarters and about how they live in a four-room apartment, things of that nature. Or as Polanski said, the usual bull S.
Right. He saw those things as devices that weren't necessary to the narrative, but he put them in to get the movie made. But when I watch the film now, I don't feel that way. I feel like that those elements work.
You don't come away noticing them and saying, oh, those are odd.
Right. In that regard, I always feel like this is a movie where I read detailed breakdowns of what this meant and that meant. And I honestly don't think Polanski at the time meant anything but what's on screen.
Well, I do think he was exploring male-female relationships and the idea of what it means to be a man and macho-ness and things of that nature. But I do sometimes wonder if there might unintentionally be something a little deeper. And I certainly can't say this is true because I'm not Polish and I didn't watch the film in 1962 when it was made. But the man says he's a writer. Now, today, when we hear him say that he's a writer, we might have a different reaction to that than someone in Poland in 1962. First, a writer is Stephen King or David DeLillo. Now, for him to be a writer and to have a four-room apartment, to have that kind of car in 1962 Poland, he can't be a writer that is an independent writer.
Right.
Pretty much has to be writing the party line. Hmm. So in many ways, even though Stalin is dead and there's been a thawing, in Poland at the time, there still was a great deal of censorship of what you could put in film and what you couldn't. So a successful writer at the time, a Polish audience might see him as a member of the communist bourgeoisie.
I see.
And here we have this hitchhiker, this young man who doesn't quite see things that way, who's not happy with the status quo, who thinks there's something wrong with the way things are set up and that this guy who's this writer, why should he have a four-room apartment? Why should he be driving a Porsche?
So the writer has caved into the system and benefited largely while this independent, perhaps liberal young man lives a day-to-day existence, having virtually nothing.
And will eventually be one of the people who helps bring down the wall and overturn the Communist Party later on. And I don't think if that's there, that's necessarily intended by Polanski, because I think he was trying to avoid politics. The movie is one of the very few movies at the time that does not mention World War II.
Okay.
So we're getting away from those movies like Andy Vida made with Canal and Ashes and Diamonds that were dealing with the immediate Polish history. And then Polanski's coming along, even though he was so much caught up in what happened in World War II, being Jewish and having to hide and having a very difficult time surviving. He makes this movie that says World War II is now irrelevant.
Right. Interesting. This is a man who's doing well. Like you said, he's got a car, he's got a beautiful wife, he's got a nice place to live, and he's got a boat. Never feel sorry for a man who has a plane, which is from The Edge. The same thing. Never feel sorry for a man with a boat.
Also, originally, the car they wanted him to be driving a Mercedes.
Ah, interesting.
And then they decided that someone of his level wouldn't be driving a Mercedes because it was too decadent.
Right.
So they gave him a Peugeot. During the filming of it, some high up guy came to check on the filming and he arrived in a Mercedes.
That's funny. To two films with a similar kind of setting, both have a cast of three, and yet so different in every way imaginable. And yet usually films set on the ocean or aboard a boat, part of the story is dictated by the sea and by the boat. That's not the case for either, really. They're not about the boats.
They're all fighting over this woman.
Right. The woman is causing the trouble. So.
And boats are usually female.
Exactly.
And what did you think of the ending?
At the end, if I recall, she tells him the truth, but he doesn't believe it. It's kind of like an open ending because he still believes that this kid is dead.
The car is at a crossroads.
Right.
And one sign says to the police and one side says to town.
Does he signal?
No, it just ends. It's an existential ending.
Right, right.
He's at a crossroads. He has to decide what is going to define his existence. But the film ends before.
So is this art or is this just a cop-out?
Probably art. It's a very existential universe. You have to decide what's going to define you. But Dead Come originally did have an ambiguous ending as well. We think the person is dead.
Right,
when
right.
He's cast off to sea. We don't really know.
Another interesting thing that we haven't discussed is that the wife betrays her husband.
Yes.
She has sex with the young man. Like Dead Calm, the parallels are really astonishing. She does have sex with this kid, just like Nicole Kidman has sex with Billy Zane.
But the motivations are different.
Of course, very different. But isn't it interesting how the bullet points are the same?
Exactly. In many ways, the story has the same basic arc, right, when it comes to plot points.
Thank God there was no radio on board. They don't call for help. They don't call for the Coast Guard or whatever those waters would have had in the way of official vessels, somebody falls overboard and you can't find them, the first thing you do is get help. They don't seem to do any of that. There doesn't seem to even be a radio on board. It's a very odd film, but I love it.
But you're a fan of Roman Polanski films overall. You're not a fan of Roman Polanski.
I'll tell you, I like Rosemary's Baby, another slow-moving disaster movie, an exercise in patience to watch, very much like Knife in the Water. I was never a fan of Chinatown, but in recent years, I've come around to appreciate it more and more. I know that's a screenplay that everybody loves and teaches and studies, but I've always found that screenplay very unfocused and meandering, but I've come to appreciate it over the years. For the most part, I'm not a fan of most of Polanski's work. Am I a fan of Tim Burton? No, but he made Ed Wood, which is, to me, one of the greatest films about low-budget Hollywood or Hollywood in general that's ever been made. I'm just a fan of that one movie, and he owes me nothing because he made that movie. You only have to make one good movie. Orson Welles made Citizen Kane. After that, you don't have to do anything. You can coast after you make Citizen Kane.
I'm a much bigger fan of Roman Polanski's films than you are until he gets exiled. Once he gets exiled,
right,
he lost something. There's something about his filmmaking that he never really gained for me until The Pianist. And then after that, his movies were better, but they still had lost something. I'm not sure exactly what he lost, but I do like his films before. Right. We did Repulsion on this podcast. We paired it with American Psycho. But I also like Cul-de-Sac. I don't like The Fearless Vampire Killers. I love Chinatown. I do think Chinatown is one of the greatest screenplays. Macbeth, I think, is one of the best Shakespeare films. But then he did lose something. I'm not sure whether he lost the money and the financial backing or he lost the technical things that he could get in Hollywood.
This is a guy with two significantly awful moments in his personal life. I'm not making any excuses for the guy, but...
Well, one not his fault, one his fault.
Once I learned what he had done, I could not look at him the same way, and it affected my viewing of his films. The personal life of an artist, it affects how we interpret the work.
I suppose it should also be mentioned that Polanski came out of what at the time some people called the Polish New Wave, but other people claim that there really was no Polish New Wave. And what they call it is the Polish film school movement, where suddenly you got a huge influx of new filmmakers. Started with Andy Wajda and Krzysztof Zanussi, Jerzy Skolimowski, and eventually resulted in people like Agnieszka Holland, and perhaps the greatest Polish director of all time, as far as I'm concerned, Krzysztof Kieślowski. But this all came out of a thawing after Stalin died, and then slowly the people started revolting against the communist rule of the time. Eventually, the wall fell, and Poland became independent again.
Interesting. Well, Polanski is pushing 88 years old right now. They're not tapping him to do the next Marvel movie.
And who knows when we're going to see his latest film because of the controversy, the one based on the Dreyfus Affair, which won Caesar. Polanski is a bit of a difficult, you know, what to do with him.
As an artist, I think his legend is secure, but it'll always be tainted.
With that, here's some more information about the film.
Sure.
This was Polanski's first feature. It was his only one in Polish and was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. This was the first Polish film ever to be nominated. Roman Polanski had intended to take on the role of the young hitchhiker, which when I read that, I went, oh my God, because he's a terrible actor. But the head of the Polish film unit, Kamera, said no, because he didn't consider the director attractive enough. And I can't argue with that either. The character's voice, however, is Polanski's.
I did read that he overdubbed the main actor, which is cool, really fascinating.
Because the actor had a strong, developed bass voice, which was wrong for the character. Krzysztof Kmita composed the film's music. The featured saxophonist was Bernd Rosengren. And Kmita composed the scores for Cul-de-Sac, Fearless Vampire Killers, and Rosemary's Baby.
I actually do own the soundtrack. It's quite a lovely score.
Knife in the Water was the basis for a low-budget 2001 American film, Catterskill Falls, set in the Catskill Mountains. And after doing Knife in the Water, American Studios brought him over, offering him to make a color remake of the film, possibly starring Henry Fonda, who I think would have been very interesting in the role. But Polanski said, why should I remake a film that is already good?
Now, here's something you might not have found. Sometime back, there was a movie with Dominic Swain, I believe it was called Dead in the Water, which is a pretty close remake of Knife in the Water. She's a rich girl who owns a 35-foot powerboat and goes out with friends. They pick up a handsome young guy who can't swim. Tensions build and he falls over or he's thrown overboard. It's not a great movie, but it's interesting to see the reinterpretation of Knife in the Water.
Great. Well, with that, let's start closing out. And I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
Movies at Sea, I'm a big fan. You know, obviously lifeboat movies are always a great point of interest for me. I'm not going to go with the obvious Hitchcock Lifeboat. I'll go with one that most people have not seen called Seven Waves Away, also known as Abandoned Ship, with Tyrone Power.
Right.
Which is basically a retelling of a real historical event where a ship sinks and there's too many people on a lifeboat. So the captain has to essentially throw people off so some can survive. And this is also the subject of the script that I wrote that got me out to LA. So Abandoned Ship, well worth looking at. Very stagey and adapted from a play, but a great cast. Sadly, Tyrone Power passed away just a couple of years later. Relatively young man, but a history of heart problems.
I saw Abandoned Ship, I think, as a late night movie when I was very, very young. And it is very good.
Another film on the high seas. Now I'm going to be really corny. The African Queen. The African Queen's always been a favorite Bogart film. At the time, Bogart and Katharine Hepburn are regarded as over the hill to be in a romantic type of film. And yet this movie was a huge success. It's also unique in that the boat itself becomes part of Bogart's character. That's another film. Again, they're stuck on the boat, right? Everybody's always stuck on the boat.
As for me, I went the hitchhiker route and chose three films that tells you maybe you should not pick up hitchhikers. One you've mentioned, of course, is The Hitcher, the 1986 thriller starring Rutger Hauer as a psychotic hitchhiker who's killing people who pick him up. One young man escapes but finds himself stalked by the killer.
Still a really good film.
The next one is The Hitchhiker, the 1953 film noir with Edmund O'Brien and William Tallman. They start Ida Lupino's career as the film director, and it's about two friends on a fishing trip who pick up a psychotic escape convict who plans to murder them when they get him to where he wants to go.
Absolutely required viewing, especially for fans of women in film, because Ida Lupino, it was a pioneer.
And then Detour, the low budget 1945 film noir.
Right.
I mentioned that because that's actually in many ways what it's known for, being incredibly low budget. It's a movie that has a strong cult following about a man trying to get to Los Angeles to meet up with his fiancée. He is first a hitchhiker and then picks up a hitchhiker. And then the story takes the direction of film noir nihilism.
So I haven't seen that probably in 30 years. So I'm glad you mentioned that because I'm going to have a look at that maybe today.
What is next? What should we be looking forward from you? What are you working on?
I am right now working on the script for a film called The Midnight Zone. And The Midnight Zone, just to put the title in context, is the point in which sunlight cannot penetrate the ocean depths. It's a little over 3,000 feet down. The movie's about two couples out at sea on a 40-foot sailboat. One of them is dying from cancer, and 1,000 miles out, he requests a Viking funeral should he pass before they reach Hawaii. The next day, he's dead. They follow through with his wishes. They put him in a rubber dinghy. They pour gasoline into it, and they set it aflame. Unfortunately, they've made a mistake, and he's not dead, and he burns to death. And this sets up a tremendous amount of tension and craziness that I cannot talk about because the film is yet to be made, but we are financed and set to go. Once everyone's inoculated, we will put this thing quickly together and we will shoot it. Dwayne Alexander Smith, who's going to be on your show shortly, I believe, is a co-producer. I am the writer. One of the reasons why I picked Dead Calm. This is a thriller that will have four characters, but ultimately after the first act, three stuck on a boat. And hopefully we'll finish that by midsummer. And at that point, we will launch into another feature film, which is a horror science fiction film, which is not financed yet, but we're enthusiastic about our chances of getting it made.
Great. Sounds very exciting. As for me, I'll go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and screenplay consultant, so I have a Howard Kasner Facebook screenplay consultation page. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues concerning screenwriting and film. I have published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, horror, and fantasy short stories. I published the second edition of my screenwriting book, or Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, and I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with actor, voiceover artist Charlie Rossman, where we discussed Superbad and American Graffiti, two films about high school teens faced with decisions about their future. What was also interesting about this is Charlie Rossman was actually in the movie Superbad, so that was a fun discussion. The next podcast will be, as you said, with writer, director, novelist Dwayne Alexander, where we will discuss Tootsie and Some Like It Hot, two films about men disguising themselves as women.
I'd like to jump in and point out that, Howard, you've helped me with a couple of screenplays, and that I'm going to plug you now shamelessly. Howard is a gifted writer, but also a very gifted screenplay analyst, very good at taking a script apart. Most screenwriters out there have had their stuff looked at. We know what feedback looks like from a studio. We know what feedback looks like from a contest or a paid service. But your feedback is of a very high standard, and I highly recommend any screenwriters out there. Howard's not particularly expensive, and he will pay very careful attention to your work and give it a look-see that you probably wouldn't get from another service.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you saying that. And with that, I want to thank you very much for being on my show.
It was a lot of fun. Let's do it again.
Great.